we went from San Francisco to many of us who had trained in at Letterman General Hospital as specialists went to Camp Young, California, which was the training camp set up, desert training center for the patent forces. And these are mostly armored units, but all sorts of army units were involved. The Fort Field Hospital, to which I belonged, was sent to the Middle East. The other few hospitals, the third and fifth, I believe, that were formed there, eventually went to the Pacific, but they were here for a good long time, but they did not, we were the only one that went to the Middle East. But at any rate, the Camp Grant experience was interesting because we got the feel of this idiot Patton, who later became, of course, a great hero, but this guy was a maniac and a brute, and he was thoroughly disliked by the Army personnel, who felt that this guy deliberately inflicted pain in the process of training, because this was character building. This was an idea which was extremely prevalent in the military of many countries in those years before they military people got smart enough to study psychology and figure out a little better how to get the most out of human beings, but they really brutalized them. But the Middle East experience, if you're interested in that.
Yes, what were your specialties that you attended?
I was an X-ray technician.
And so you went from San Francisco to train in the desert at Camp Young,
which no longer exists. It was between Indio and Desert Center, on the road from Indio to Blythe.
Yes. And was Patton in charge of the training out there, or?
Patton was in charge of the whole operation.
But not specifically of your training?
No, actually, we didn't do that much training out there. We functioned during the maneuvers. We were attached to an evacuation hospital, which was the main hospital unit. The hospital was set up there was no town there, but it was the hospital was set up on the road, the Iron Mountain Road, which goes north of the main highway. And it was just the road from Desert Center to Parker. It's all up on that road, but we were up near Iron Mountain, which is a really desolate desert area. This is where most of the maneuvers took place.
And
you
went from there to
the Yes. We went from there to the Middle East. We went across the country by train and then to a very circuitous route to the Middle East. We left the East Coast on the Mauritania, which was a British Cunard liner that was a high-speed ship and traveled alone. It could outrun submarines, so there were many of these transports to travel at high speed. The only danger was considered the German pocket battleships, which were operating in the South Atlantic at that time. And so they were pretty nervous about them. As a matter of fact, we were scheduled to go from Newport News to Rio de Janeiro to refuel, and then from Rio to Port Elizabeth, South Africa, for another refueling stop. But because of sightings of German warships in the Atlantic, our course was changed when we were not too far from Rio de Janeiro, off, probably off the northern Brazil coast. We made a hard left turn and went clear across the Atlantic to Freeport, Africa. When we got just out of sight of the African coast, we probably were at least within 50 miles of the African coast, we turned back and went to Rio. Apparently the reports were that the German ships had moved and that we had evaded them. So we went into Rio and refueled, and one of the great irritations of my life is that nobody was allowed off a ship in Rio. And we were on this grand tour, and we couldn't get off the ship. We were scheduled to go to Port Elizabeth, but once again they discovered there was a German wolf pack of U-boats hanging around the Cape of Good Hope. So the ship was put on a different course, and we went 1,000 miles below the Cape into the Antarctic Ocean and ran into a really roaring storm, which is the one really large storm at sea that I ever saw. It's interesting how frightened a lot of those people who had never been around the water were. Just absolutely terrified by a great storm at sea. The ship just shuddered and shook, took solid water over the sun deck at 80 feet above the waterline. It was a horrendous storm. I was working in the ship's hospital, and we had 100 guys at least who were just totally incapacitated from seasickness. Terror, just dark terror. They thought their days were done. But at any rate, instead of going to Port Elizabeth, we went to Durban. And we were in Durban for 2 days, and we were the first American troops coming through Durban, and so we received a tremendous welcome, and it was an interesting experience. I had a day ashore there, met a South African communist who was a teacher in Indian school. Durban was, at that time, I guess still is, the center of Indian population in South Africa. And they fed us and took us around, and we met a bunch of the local radicals and some old survivors of the Boer War who had been on both sides, members of the same family, incidentally.
How did you make connections with the local radicals?
They came down to the boat just to pick up some Americans and give them a day in the town. It just turned out that there were thousands of South Africans who were out to meet us, and many of them were quite willing. Most of the guys I knew that got off the ship, they went off with different families, and they took them home and fed them and drove them around, showed them the sights, and filled them full of horrible South African brandy. Generally had a very good time. But it was just my luck that I ran into this guy, which was useful to me in that I got the feeling of the racial tension in South Africa that I had never had before. I didn't know what it was all about. And also the continuing bitterness between the English-speaking and Afrikaans-speaking South Africans. I wasn't aware of the depth of that chasm. Of course, at that time, Smuts was the president of South Africa, or whatever his title was. Maybe Prime Minister. And the English group had the power, the political power, and the Afrikaners were on the outside. But later, up in the Middle East, I worked with a good many South African units and discovered that it was an absolute no-no to talk about the solution of the racial problem in South Africa to white South Africans. this was the subject that they were so fearful about. They that they wouldn't discuss it with foreigners. The only South African I ever talked to about this, I talked to some South African blacks who weren't going to talk about it. Happened to be patients in our hospital when we were up in Libya, but the South African whites, I never met a South African white who was free to discuss the issue.
Did they draft blacks in South Africa?
I don't know if they were drafted, but
are they allowed to be in the army?
Yes, they had some. Of course, there were so many black units in the British Army from various African countries. I was never really able to sort them out. I couldn't tell one units for another. And many of the blacks were in various kinds of service companies, and of course this was a racially segregated army, as was even the American Army at that time. Mm-hmm. And so the black units were mostly service units as opposed to line, you know, infantry and such. I didn't see any black infantry. But the trip to Africa was made with the troops on one ship and our hospital equipment on another. The hospital equipment got sunk. So when we landed in Egypt at Port Tufik at the southern end of the Suez Canal, the Battle of Alamein was being fought. At the time we landed, we got the first word of the Battle of Alamein about the time our ship was entering the Red Sea, the Gulf of Aden. And the principal battle, I guess, didn't take more than 24 hours before the Germans and Italians were in retreat. And by the time we landed, there was a very, very good situation on the battlefront. And here were we, a unit with no equipment. So they shipped us just to get us out from underfoot because they didn't want us in a way. We were of no use. They shipped us up to Palestine, and we went to a British Red Camp outside of Tel Aviv at Lida Airport, actually, what is now called Lod. At that time was the largest, I guess, the largest military airport in Palestine, which was a British protectorate thing. We know state of Israel. But I had about 6 or 8 weeks in Palestine, which was extremely interesting because I really got the feel of the country. I had a pretty good job for wartime military duty. I ran the dispensary in this rest camp one day a week. I was the enlisted man in charge. And one day a week, I put in 24-hour duty. I slept in the place. We had some beds in there for patients, and sometimes we'd have a patient in there, but we might go a couple of weeks without a pillow and bed. But at any rate, I had 6 days off, and I was a sergeant, and this gave me a certain amount of freedom to get in a lot of places in Tel Aviv that were ranked. There were lots of bars and restaurants with officers only. These were British rules. There were only perhaps 200 Americans in Palestine, although there were lots of British Empire troops. But actually the group that was in the rest camp that we went into was part of the Londonderry Regiment at the time we went. And they had been in reserve at the time of Alamein, and a week or two after we got there, well, they moved out and went into the line chasing the Germans back across North Africa. But at any rate, Tel Aviv was generally considered the best lead town in the Mediterranean area. And here I was with 6 days a week to enjoy the attractions of Tel Aviv, which is was a pretty little Mediterranean town at that time, much, much smaller than it is now. It's interesting that the Arab city of Jaffa, which is contiguous, was out of bounds to Allied soldiers because the Arabs, Palestinian Arabs, their leadership had been pro-Nazi, and the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, who was the political and spiritual leader of the Arabs in the area, was a solid Nazi, so the Arabs were considered the enemy. The Jews were, of course, powerfully anti-Nazi and strongly pro-allied in their position, and they were trusted and accepted. And incidentally, the welcome that the Americans got in Palestine is unbelievable. I mean, we were just taken in with open arms, and we were always being invited to dinner in homes, and they were austere times in that country, and the people shared everything they had. I mean, we were much better off than they were, and yet they were just push their limited food on us, and they're very generous people. And I was tremendously impressed with the European Jews who had settled in Palestine. This is what the major part of the Jewish group in Tel Aviv consisted of. The older established Jewish communities had been in Palestine for a long time, were in other areas, and Tel Aviv was a European city. And I would say that probably maybe one in three of the Tel Aviv citizens was perfectly fluent in English. So it was an extremely easy place for Americans without foreign language capacities to move and flourish. And businesses, everybody, you go in any business, and the staff could speak English, the bars, hotels. But at any rate, after we assembled enough equipment to get a third of our unit in the field, since by the time we landed in Palestine, I was the only X-ray technician who had any formal training, I was sent out with the first unit from our group, and we functioned, incidentally, all during World War II as separate platoons of this hospital. If the three platoons were all assembled, in theory it made a 400-bed hospital, but a single platoon could support a 100-bed hospital. So we operated as 100-bed hospitals, and we were the only North American military hospital in the field in the Middle East, outside of the city of Cairo, where there was a general hospital. So we went out to the border of Egypt and Libya at a place called Gambit Junction, which was the site of several American airports. And our role in that campaign was to be the hospital support group for the old 9th Air Force, which was an American Air Force unit attached to the British 8th Army. They were actually a support group for the British 8th Army. So we were in the British theater. We were issued British uniforms. We had the funniest looking hospital in the world, I guess. We had Indian tents, many Indian tents. We had a pickup of German, Italian, British, and American vehicles. Our medical equipment was pickup, odds and ends, and we were a real funny looking outfit. But our colonel, who was a warm-hearted old Irish drunk by the name of Conroy, a poor doctor, but a pretty good humanitarian, and an old National Guard type from the Middle West. He didn't really, he liked to play at being a soldier when he was sober, but he never really had much to do with running a hospital, and he was the only person with any military experience in the unit. And as a consequence, it ran as a civilian hospital, and it could well have been the model for the hospital in MASH, except that we were not a high-powered surgical hospital, as MASH units were. But it was a very informal kind of an outfit with a bunch of odd collection of characters, individualists. The colonel called the group that I ran with the slovenly intellectuals, because we refused to wear the proper military costumes, and the British in that desert theater tended to a good deal of informality, and it was very, very easy for us to catch the habits, and the colonel was just never able to make a very military-looking outfit out of the group. He gave up after a while. It didn't take him long to realize that he was outnumbered. So he went back to his tent and drank. One time this old guy was in his tent for 5 or 6 weeks, and we never saw him. And he had his Batman bringing his food and take out the slop buckets and so forth, and this guy never even came out of his tent. He stayed drunk in his tent for that length of time. So he was out of the way, and the hospital ran very well. We had an excellent reputation, good food, good medical care. It was a very good group. But we were at Gambit for a while, and then the second platoon came through, and I had trained an x-ray technician to leave with the hospital in Gambit. So I then left that unit and went with the second unit to establish a hospital in Benghazi, Libya. And this again was a hospital serving American bomber groups which were operating in Benghazi. The bombers that made the famous Palestine raid in Romania came from that area. And, our unit was there taking care of those people when they came back. I had left Benghazi by that time when they established the third hospital unit in Tripoli. I then moved to that unit, and I was 6 months in Tripoli. It was my longest stay in the Middle East in one place. But I was tremendously impressed. We travel by truck, of course, along the long desert road. It's about 1,000 air miles from Alexandria to Tripoli. And I don't know what the road mileage is, but maybe 1,400 miles. Most of it is within sight of the ocean, much of it is. And that Mediterranean coast is beautiful. Just beautiful. Water's beautiful. Those North African deserts are not beautiful. They are ugly. And unlike the impressions that most people have of the African deserts, great rolling sand dunes, there are a few sand dunes along that long stretch of desert. The most prominent material on the ground is rock. And very, very little vegetation. Our drier parts of our California desert just look like a blooming oasis compared to the drier parts of the African desert. There's just nothing going. But the coast is beautiful, and the Mediterranean waters, every place that I ever got to any of the really polluted areas in the Mediterranean in general, but I saw a lot of the Mediterranean, and it's a beautiful piece of water. The prettiest place in all my travels was the little port of Mersinatru, about 60 miles west of Alexandria. in the Egyptian coast. This was one of Cleopatra's watering places, and you can see why. Absolutely beautiful natural setting. It's a little tiny harbor with an island in it. And beautiful water. Lovely sand beaches. Just thousands of miles of beautiful beaches in North Africa. No surf, incidentally. But we went from Tripoli to a staging point in Tunisia for the invasion of Italy. And our unit, because we had worked all the time with the Air Force, and because our standard operating procedure was always to evacuate serious patients to a general hospital in Cairo by air, we were given the job in Italy of setting up the air evacuation hospital to move the early casualties of the Italian campaign back to the general hospitals, which were then in North Africa. And so we went in on the beach at Salerno and moved up to Naples and set up our air evacuation hospital just outside of Naples. We spent a good deal of time there, 6 months or so, and then the Germans threw one of their more successful air raids against a huge armada of American supply ships in the harbor of Bari, Italy. Sunk the fleet. And when they sunk the fleet, they sunk all the hospitals for the 15th Air Force, which was the big bomber command for Italy. And they had a desperate need for hospital units. And we were experienced and well thought of by the Air Force guys, so they requested our units. And so we went to the Adriatic coast of Italy, and all three of our units spent then the rest of the war in that area, passing the Air Force. It's interesting because our air evacuation role was over in Naples about the time of the Bari raid, and we were scheduled for duty in Milan, supporting American infantry in Milan, which is a rougher kind of assignment than we had. We had rather soft assignments. But due to the Bari raid, we never made infantry support. We were Air Force support units in kind of war. And the hospital traveled around, I guess there were three different locations on the unit I was with. And I was there until the end of the war in Europe.
I
understand
what you're saying. It occurred to me to say, why didn't the Air Force have its own hospitals? But the Air Force is part of the Army. There wasn't any Air Force. It was the Air Corps.
Yeah.
Part of the Army.
Yeah. Yeah, it was the Army Air Corps in those days. But it was quite a separate branch. And vastly superior in their personnel relations than the ground force units in the Army, which was still kind of brutal. The ground commander in Italy was General Mark Clark. He was a real jerk. And the standard treatment of the combat forces was to keep them in the lines until they were exhausted. Pull them out of the line for rest and rehabilitation, which meant giving them a week to get drunk and sober up, and then putting them on a hard training regime in a very sparse camp, as far from the cities and decency, and leave opportunity as possible. Full field inspection every morning, and just the kind of indignities in combat soldiers, despises the passions they would make
the rest and rehabilitation so uncomfortable and so odious that the troops were begged to go back in the line. It was a brutalizing kind of activity and typical of the way the many of the ground force units operated. The Air Force, on the other hand, was quite concerned about the morale of their personnel. They gave them lots of perks. They were sure that they got their booze and liquor. People worked decent hours. And there was a great deal of informality between officers and enlisted men in the Air Force that didn't exist in the ground force. It was just well, it's much more like the more modern military. It was better organized in terms of the use of techniques to get cooperation out of the people rather than just driving them like a bunch of slaves. We did have the interesting experience in our unit of always working with the odds and ends of everything, like the Adriatic coast there. We served some Canadian units, South African Air Force units, the Royal Hellenic Air Force, which probably consisted of a couple hundred people and maybe four or five aircraft, the Italian Air Force, which in the latter stages of World War II in Europe was brought into the Allied command. From time to time, as ground troops went through, moving back into rear areas, we had just units of Polish Legion, which was in Italy, and all kinds of British units. We always made it a practice of serving any Allied units. Unlike most hospitals, we could only take troops of their own stripe. We treated all the Allied troops the same. This was something that got started when we were in the Middle East. And we made so many friends among these various units that we were always treated extremely favorably by all of these other military commands. So we had a kind of a luxurious status. I mean, we tended to get extra food and extra booze and extra consideration about vehicles. We would have gifts of liberated equipment, civilian cars and stuff of this kind, and motorcycles for the troops. There was a great deal of scrounging in World War II, and we were not in a position to do the scrounging like many ground forces moved around a lot, but they did our scrounging for us, and we got really more stuff from the British, sort of luxury items like automobiles than we were using in the
American. What about medical equipment?
We had the standard American equipment after a little time in the desert, and it was modest, simple, and adequate for the kind of thing we were doing. It was not adequate for running a good surgical hospital, but it was adequate. We had a lot of tremendous amount of Italian medical equipment given to us when we were in North Africa. And our colonel, who was a funny old duck, couldn't bear to leave this stuff behind. So we took a couple of extra truckloads of stuff sort of to Italy, including a couple of tons of drugs, which had been recovered from Italian supply depots in the Tripoli area, which is a big important base for the Italian army. And when we got to Italy, we couldn't use this stuff. It was not government issue, and the medical authorities in Italy were allowed to use it. And we gave it to civilian hospitals in Italy, and I mean, we were really heroes because drugs were
extremely short time. Anyway, everything was in short supply. Food, clothes, fuel, you name it. And so we made friends with a lot of the care in the hospital. We made sure this guy loaded him up with drugs that they couldn't obtain. And that's just bad.
So on VE Day, what happened?
Well, VE Day came. I was a high tank person. I mean, discharged people according to points and sent them back to the United States. I was married, and by that time I had a child. I'd had a lot of time overseas. And so I was a high point man, available for, you know, once for immediate return to the United States. So they broke up our unit, and most of the guys in the unit were sent to run rest camps for troops in, up on the Swiss border, and Venice, Florence, the loveliest parts of northern Italy. And I went to a replacement depot in Naples, where I sat for 3 months, while all of the units were being returned to the United States to might be sent on to the Far East because of one stand still going. And when VJ Day occurred, I was still sitting in Italy. And after VJ Day, they managed to get the odds and ends of troops out who had been sent over for immediate return to the United States. So I had three kind of dreary months in the Temple Depot outside of Naples, Italy. But this was all wasted on. We get into town, buy some of these paintings that you see on the wall here. It's good to be getting a decent meal once in a while. Then came home on a freighter. Left in a cotton hold and had about 11 or 12 days from Naples to Newport. And it was terrible, uncomfortable, miserable trip. It was worse. Two trips I took in the military was a trip home. I did have one interesting experience. I got a furlough home from Italy during World War II. At the time they established the rotation program, there were some of the commanders who felt that they had personnel in their units that they didn't want to let go because they couldn't replace them. And so for a period of only 2 months, as an experiment, they allowed what they called a fellow program home in Europe. And I got in on the first month of that. Actually, there were a total of four fellows from our outfit who got that deal. And the laboratory technician and myself came back on that first trip. And I got a month at home during the war, which required my being 3 months gone from my unit. It took me a month to get home. Mm-hmm. And then the Seaboy across the Atlantic, and then train across the U.S. to Monterey, California, the old Presidio, then, and then home. And I got 30 days at home, went back to Monterey, then back across the country by train, across the Atlantic again by ship to my unit. And I was gone 3 months in the unit, 30 days at home. Well, now that's not really the efficient operation. They didn't do that with very many people. I don't imagine there were more than a few hundred people from the whole European theater who got the furlough. But it was because I was eligible for rotation, but the colonel told this lab technician and myself, he says, there's no point in you and stuff and signing up for rotation because you're not going to get it. Because I can't afford to let you go. But if you're interested in furlough, fine. Well, most people were not interested in the furlough because they hated the idea of coming back. They thought if they ever got back in the States, they'd stay there. Mm-hmm. And as a matter of fact, that's the way it works. Because very few of the soldiers who were rotated home from Europe ever went to Far East. But we took what we could get, and it was an interesting experience. So I did an awful lot of traveling in the Army.
did you do that you finally got to come home?
Finally got to come home, came, flew across the country to Castillo in Northern California near Marysville, and got discharged up there and came home and,
Was that the first time you had to fly? All the other times you had to go on the
train? Yes. Yes. Well, we didn't fly around Italy. We would fly up to Rome. We'd all crawl in the belly of a bomber or something and, you know, a little R&R project, but, I had some nice little vacations in the military overseas because I was the only technician, X-ray technician in the unit usually. And if I was in the day off, they'd have to bring in an X-ray technician from some other unit to take my place. Well, that wasn't very convenient to do. So the way my vacation schedule, day off schedule usually works, I was 3, 4, 5 months on, that's 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And then I get a week off. And I get a week in Naples or a week in Rome. And when I was in North Africa, I got a 2 week stint off, and I spent a week in Cairo and a week in Alexandria. And on this particular trip in Cairo and Alexandria, I was the only lift again. The two officers went back. And I went with them, and they went to the Shepherd Hotel in Cairo or some fancy place, and I went to the Red Cross Hospital in the same way in Alexandria. But I was totally on my own with a week in each of these excellent leave times, and that very enriching cultural experience. Got to see the pyramids and the palaces of King Farouk and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, he was inside there, wasn't he?
Yes. He was out of favor. He was distrusted by the British because the Egyptians would have welcomed the Germans with open arms. During World War II, they were just, the people in Alexandria were just all ready to lay out the welcome carpets for the invading Germans. And the Germans got as close to the Palamedes as the Alexandria could be done. And it wasn't very far, less than 100 miles, I think. And the British were very well aware of the fact that the Egyptians felt that the Germans would liberate the country from British colonial rule. So Farouk was under surveillance and out of circulation. Egypt was the most miserable area that I saw in my travels. The contrast in Egypt was unbelievable, from the extremely rich to the absolute poor to the poor. The ship we went over on, the first time the Mauritania, there were a few missionaries to be aboard. They were the only civilians aboard outside of the British crew. But these people had been missionaries in China for many years, and they were run out of China by the Japanese invasion of China. And then established some kind of a mission activity in Cairo, and I had a number of conversations with these people on the ship, and they told me that they had never seen people as desperate or as poor any place in the Far East as they had seen in Cairo. It was just beyond belief the poverty and the desperation of those people then. I never got into the Cairo one. They were out of bounds for truth. Once when I was wandering around Cairo, I about walked into the one, and the British MP grabbed me and grabbed me by the shoulder, and he said, "Yank, he says, don't walk down that street." He said, "You won't get a block." He said, "Okay."